Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater Law Society. Would those students please stand?
Both of them.
Small society.
Well, we're delighted you braved the weather. We won't ask what happened to your other 13 colleagues who I've got listed down here, but we're delighted, and we're delighted always to see the Law Society. You are a perennial. You come every year and have for many, many years. So thank you for coming, and you may be seated. But let me ask you, now that I've had you be seated, are you familiar with the case we're about to hear? Would you like a summary of the case? Pardon me?
Yeah.
Oh, you have a summary. Would anyone else like a summary of the case that you're about to hear? It makes listening easier. Okay, the marshal will give one to you if you raise your hands. No problem. Okay, I'm going to call our second case for this morning, 05-AP-2030, Leidinger versus Van Buren Management. Arguing on behalf of DuBart, Inc. and Heritage Mutual Insurance Company is Arthur Simpson. And arguing on behalf of Leidinger et al. Is Mr. Aiken, Attorney Aiken. Attorney Simpson?
Thank you and good morning. Also appearing with me this morning, Christine Rice. I represent DuBart, Inc., Barth & Hire Construction, Heritage Mutual Insurance Company, now known as Acuity, defendants, respondents, petitioners in this matter. We're here on one very simple and direct issue. Is the evidence of amounts paid in a personal injury action for claimed medical expenses admissible for the purpose of assisting the fact finder, be it judge or jury, in determining what the reasonable value of services would be in that particular set of circumstances? We believe the central issue here is not one of suppressing evidence, but of letting the jury consider the issue. We are not here asking, as a matter of law, that the medical expenses be capped at the amount paid. That is the ground that has already been plowed by this court.
Well, how is this, and I hate to jump in right away, but I will.
Doesn't stop you, right?
No, doesn't stop me. How is this different from the Kaufman case? What, I mean, this is the point that your opposing counsel makes. This is right on point.
No, I disagree with that. I think it is significantly different. The Kaufman case, the legal issue was whether, as a matter of law, the medical bills were limited to the amount actually paid as opposed to the amount billed. In the Kaufman case, the party stipulated that the amount billed was a reasonable charge. The particularly critical language from the Kaufman decision is found at paragraph 52 in that decision, with Justice Bradley writing for the court. She stated, in the absence of a separate basis for relevance of the collateral source evidence, evidence of such payment should have been deemed inadmissible. And then in footnote 10, it stated, because the reasonableness of the amounts billed by the plaintiff's health care providers was a subject of the party's stipulation, it cannot be said that the defendant's presentation of this evidence was material to the valuation of the expenses in the case. That's what distinguishes this from the Kaufman case. That's what the trial court, Judge Kremers, noted in his particular decision. We are here asking not for a rule of suppression. We are asking that simply we be allowed to present to the jury what the amount is that's actually paid, what reflects the real market value as an evidentiary fact.
Counselor, just so I'm sure that I understand the facts correctly, did this jury hear both what was billed and what was paid?
No. The jury only heard what was, the jury didn't hear either fact because of the stipulation and the way the parties reached this agreement. Procedurally, what happened is that the bills, as I recall, were roughly $154,000. Yeah. As is typical with the standard practice these days, the amount actually paid was, I believe, around $111,000. We brought a motion that we be allowed to present the amount paid. The trial court said you are allowed to consider as evidence the 111. You can also consider as evidence the 154, and the jury can decide. Confronted with that situation, the plaintiffs and the defendants agreed that the bills would be the lower figure. And that's the figure that was entered by the jury. That's the figure that I believe the court actually entered with respect to the medical bills in the
case. That troubles me, and the reason it troubles me is because there are lots of places where a jury is given the task of finding the reasonable value of X. For example, if you have a foreclosure action on a mortgage, most mortgages will say that the mortgagee, as part of their process, gets the reasonable value of their attorney's services. You have to present that to a jury, and there are arguments about whether what was billed was too much. You also have it if you have quantum merit, which is a theory when you don't have a contract that you can actually show, but you're getting the reasonable value of the services provided, okay? And again, the jury looks at evidence to determine that question. I'm a little confused on why the jury didn't just get to look at this evidence.
Well, that was because of the stipulation that was reached between the parties. It had nothing to do. We were ready, and under the trial court's ruling, we were ready to present the amount billed and the amount paid and let the chips fall where they may. Mr. Aiken's client agreed at that point, well, if that amount's going to the jury, we're just going to agree that that's the amount that should be awarded. As a lawyer, I can't do any better than that for my client. At that point, they're agreeing this is the $111,000 figure. I'm saying, okay, I accept that because that's what I think the bill should be, the amount actually paid.
Okay, well, I'll pester him about that when
all right,
it's his turn to
the
get
court,
up there.
Thank you.
The counsel, you referenced footnote 10 of the Kaufman decision.
Correct.
And when I look at footnote 10, I see that it cites the Hack versus State Farm. And Hack deals with the evidence being admissible for impeachment purposes under the collateral source rule. Doesn't sound like this is an impeachment case or that it's admissible for other purposes such as that cited within footnote 10. I'm not sure how you get from footnote 10 how that extends to the rest of your argument.
Well, the exact wording is there, because the reasonableness of the amounts billed by the plaintiff's health care providers was the subject of a stipulation, it cannot be said that the defendant's presentation of this evidence was material to the valuation of the expenses in this case. That's what the court wrote at footnote 10. I agree with you. The Hack case talks about using it for impeachment purposes, but what's right there?
Footnote 10 refers to the language in the opinion that says that in the absence of a separate basis for the relevance of this collateral source evidence, evidence of such payments should have been deemed inadmissible. So I think you have to read the footnote in the context of the actual language of the opinion. And when you read the two together and the citation to the Hack case, I'm not sure that footnote goes as far as you suggest in your brief.
Well, I have three things to address. First of all, the decision itself says the amounts paid by the plaintiff and his insurers were irrelevant to the determination of the causal link between treatment and injury. And it says there was a stipulation as to reasonableness. Then it says, in the absence of a separate basis for relevance of the collateral source evidence, evidence should have been deemed inadmissible. That's the first thing that's said. All right? What you're telling me is you intellectually didn't want to jump to the Hack case and say...
Well, that's the footnote that's cited to that sentence.
And that's what I'm coming to.
All right.
The Hack case refers to as supporting authority in the footnote, is the way that I read it. And the Hack case did talk about impeachment. But to do all that is to simply close our eyes to the text of footnote 10, which says, because the reasonableness was subject of a stipulation, it cannot be said the presentation of this evidence was material to the valuation of the expenses in this case. My comment is this, well, that's why we're here. Because we're not agreeing that the fantasy billings are reasonable figures, period. We believe that the fair market price is what has been set by the health insurers,
Please stand up.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Right.
The fair market value is what's been set by the health insurers, is regulated by the insurance commissioner. The attorney general is litigating in Milwaukee County, and we filed that with our supplemental authorities here, has litigated the issue that, in fact, the bills are typically 37% higher than what the actual charges are, and negotiating for that for the uninsured. This is really, the market rate is what is paid. This issue, and that's what the Lautenschlager case talks about. I'm skipping ahead a little bit here. But we should be allowed to tell the jury what's paid for these bills. We should be allowed to tell the other side, the plaintiff should be allowed to say what the bills are. Let the chips fall where they may is our
counsel, premise. I wanted to ask you about the Lautenschlager case, because I know that that's a big part of your argument in this court. And I went back and I've looked at Lautenschlager, and I've got it right here. And in Lautenschlager, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be a mistake, and I've read this quickly, but my understanding of the Lautenschlager case is that there is no evidence in that case of a payment from a collateral source. What you have is a payment, at least as I read the facts, a payment by the individual who's making the claim. And the language, as I understood Lautenschlager, deal specifically with, well, if you have paid something, that may be relevant to the value of the services performed here. But I don't see any evidence that there was an insurance company involved, that there was workman's comp, that there was any payment by any third party. And I don't see Lautenschlager as a collateral source case. Am I misreading it?
It's an evidentiary. The way I see it is it sets forth that basic evidentiary rule that we are allowed to put into evidence what it's like anything that you dispute. You can, let's say that you're having your car repaired, for example, and the guy says, well, I accepted $3,000 for it. He comes to court and says, well, I think $6,000 is a reasonable charge. Nobody in the world would say you'd be precluded from putting that $3,000 into evidence. What the Lautenschlager case says is the amount paid or the liability incurred is merely evidence which can go to the jury to assist it in arriving at a reasonable award. Whether it be the niceties of collateral source or whatever, that's the issue as to what's relevant evidence in determining what's a reasonable value. I think reasonable value is the term.
The reason I raised the question is because, as I understand the collateral source rule, the courts have made a policy decision that certain evidence, whether relevant or irrelevant, is inadmissible. So I understand the argument that you make that this may be relevant in certain contexts, but if this is not a collateral source case, if we're not dealing with a collateral source, I'm not sure that answers the question with respect to the policy that's underlying the collateral source rule.
Well, I like to come to that policy because I think that's one of the thinner reeds in the civil justice system to suppress, particularly to suppress evidence on as opposed to finding as a matter of law. What's the punishment? And the reasons that are cited for the sacred collateral source rule, number one is it's some sort of punishment and deterrence. I don't think anyone on this court can legitimately, or anyone anywhere can legitimately say that the collateral source rule prevents accidents or makes our state any safer or makes one whit of difference.
Are you in favor of getting rid of the collateral source rule in Wisconsin? When you say sacred, I hear a bit of ridicule in that phrase.
Good pickup.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, I think
you want to desacramentalize the sacred.
I think all it does, frankly, if that were the issue before the court, I think all that it does is create a windfall, increase transactional costs. In our state, it's a total windfall. If the bills are 100 and it's paid for 60, and that health care provider comes back later and says, well, wait a minute, I think I should be entitled to that 100 because that's what you got on your personal injury settlement. Under Dorr versus Sacred Heart, a court of appeals decision, the health care provider can actually be sued for interfering with the health insurance contract.
I've read many cases or summaries of cases since 1921 where we affirm the collateral source rule. Are those just to be tossed, then, from your point of view?
Well, if you're asking from a global perspective, I think that's bad law, because I don't think the collateral source rule contributes significantly to making our state safer. I don't think there's any punishment or deterrence from it. I think it's absurd to call it a so-called wrongful fortuity. My goodness, just about everything in the personal injury system is some sort of fortuity. To pick this one out and single it out, I think, is very questionable. And I think the concept that this is somehow a discount that we're talking about, what we're talking about is real-world economics here.
Let's return, since we started with in this discussion, the Kaufman case, the very first question out of the box by Justice Wilcox addressed that case. And you cited to paragraphs 52 and footnote 10. But there are other paragraphs, of course, in the opinion that deal with the principles. Application of principles started with paragraph 48 and then ended there shortly, so 52 is included in that. But the first part, most of the opinion deals with the principles of collateral source. And it seems to me that those paragraphs, 29, 30, 32, 46, 53, are contrary to your position. Let's take, I could start with 30 or 29. Let's start with 30 because it's easiest. The collateral source rule allows the plaintiff to seek recovery of reasonable value of medical services without consideration of gratuitous medical services rendered or payments made by outside sources on the plaintiff's behalf, including insurance payments, citing Ellsworth. You think we should be considering insurance payments?
Well, we've gotten down two different tracks here. I want to make sure that everyone understands exactly where we are with this case. My belief is that the collateral source rule is a dubious one, even to the point where a jury would be allowed to recover a plaintiff would be allowed to recover the amounts paid. However, the court has already ruled that as a matter of law, the collateral source rule is not going to cap benefits with the amount paid. That's not the issue we're here on today, is a much different one. The issue is whether or not we're allowed to present to the jury and let them decide what is a reasonable charge for these services.
Why doesn't paragraph 32 take care of that? Explaining the collateral source rule, it says, it prevents the discounted rates on the insurer's behalf from affecting the plaintiff's recovery of the reasonable value of medical services rendered. Thus, the rule renders irrelevant the amounts of the collateral source payment and precludes a reduction in medical expenses based on those payments. Why doesn't that answer the case before us today?
Well, number one, because the issue in Kaufman wasn't the issue that we are presenting today. Number two, I will acknowledge, and I think the court may have hit most of them, if not all of them, in your listing of paragraphs there. There are several instances where it's indicated that in the Kaufman decision that the collateral source rule does not preclude the plaintiff an opportunity to recover the fantasy billing or the amount billed.
Do you think all billings by health care providers are fantasy?
The ones that I'm seeing are the ones that the Attorney General was seeing. I mean, I'm certain.
It's your position that all billings by health care providers that you see, you can't comment on those that you don't see, are fantasy. That's your position? It sounds like that's your position.
I am very reluctant to say all, because I'm sure there is
all that you see.
A scenario that can be concocted, and I'm stretching my mind to see if I can recall one. All I'm asking for this court to do in this particular case is let whoever wants to make the claim present the bill, let us present what was paid for it, and let the jury decide.
If it's fantasy, I wonder why there are certain groups that pay that amount. I mean, why in a workers' comp case, the workers' comp carrier is foolish enough to pay that fantasy bill?
I think that varies from compensation carrier to compensation
carrier.
What about
the med pay under your policy? The med pay typically pays what's billed. Why are they paying that fantasy bill?
They pay it if that's their choice to pay it. Whether they could get a better deal if they negotiated or not, or whether there is a better deal, is another issue. I'm sure there are.
What about the uninsured that doesn't get a charity discount and they pay that bill? Do you think that's fantasy to them?
Well, according to the Attorney General, who's currently litigating with health care providers, that's something they shouldn't be doing. That's a practice that at least the Attorney General's, the previous Attorney General, keep in mind, but the Attorney General's office felt that that was to the point where it was a consumer practice that should not be tolerated. Now, whether that's a, you know, we can sit here and talk about, well, maybe it's a fantasy, it's not a fantasy of people that are actually paying it. I'm sure there are arguments that can be made about that. And that's what we're asking. Let a jury decide. Don't create a rule that where we say, well, we're looking for reasonable value, but we're only going to allow in what the billing is. And that's what the Court of Appeals has done in this particular case.
Counselor, if we affirm the Court of Appeals, don't we then decide as a matter of law what the reasonable value is?
Essentially, yes. You've
so there's no more fact-finding on it then.
Well, basically, that's right. The Court of Appeals seem to be suggesting, well, the defense could hire an expert. I wonder what my poor expert's going to say. Well, the amount billed, they usually accept the amount billed is 37% less than this. That's what the Attorney General indicated. And the first objection is, well, no, that's the amount paid. You're not allowed to bring it up. It's tough to bring an expert in to testify when you strip them of any foundation facts.
Let me just go back to this. The issue in this case is how do you prove reasonable medical expenses, right?
You prove them how you are, what evidence you're allowed to let the jury consider.
Okay. And you want to bring in the bill that was actually incurred, and you do not say that that per se is the reasonable medical expenses. You're not asking that. So you disagree with Justice Sykes' dissent, which says that the reasonable bill of that what was actually incurred is the measure of damages. That's what she says in her dissents.
Well,
you disagree with that.
I don't think I need to get to that. Personally, I would agree with that because I think that's what the measure of damages should be. It isn't just about every other context. However, that's not the issue that's before the court today.
Oh,
my
right.
Only issue is let the jury decide if that's reasonable or if the higher number is reasonable.
Right. That's what your issue is. That's not what her position was. I just want to clarify what the position of the dissent
sure.
is.
That decision did not carry the day, and that's why I'm not re-arguing.
Right, and that's why you're not relying on it. That's very important, I think, to understand about your argument.
Mm-hmm.
Then the position you're taking now is that you cannot show a reasonable medical expense unless you bring in what was actually paid because your witness can't testify as to the fantasy, as you put it. Right.
Well, I
don't understand that argument at all.
Okay.
I don't see why you can't have an expert who says studied expenses, studied actual payments, and has looked at Medicare, Medicaid, this health insurance, that health insurance, et cetera, looked at all the hospital bills, and it's one-third off is what the hospital's really collecting. Because this is all make-believe.
In other words, that's what the defense expert would be allowed to do without limitation by the collateral source rule, to show what's typically paid in other situations. I guess my comment on that is,
You're not saying, the problem with the collateral source rule is that you don't want the jury to be affected under the collateral source rule by the payments outside. They're irrelevant. And if they're irrelevant for damages, then maybe they should be irrelevant for the measure of the damages, evidence of the damages. Whereas what you're presenting has nothing to do what was actually paid in the particular case, but you're just dealing with reasonable expectations. Reasonable medical expenses as shown by actual practice in the trade. And I'll tell you where we see this all the time. Tuition at colleges. College says tuition is $15,000 or $30,000. When you look at all the figures, most, if not all, have some sort of financial aid and that the real tuition is $20,000.
Well,
so this concept of fantasy is not limited to medical care.
Well, and you go out to buy a GM car, and you may see the sticker price is one thing, but the real price is another one.
That's right.
Another example of that. And I think these are legitimate economic realities that should be my one comment I did want to make.
That's right, but you don't have to have the evidence of what was actually paid in this case, because what's actually paid in this case may have nothing to do with reasonable medical care. There are too many other variables.
Why isn't that a relevant fact? Why play hide the bunny with that if we're going to go through all this other, we're going to let everything else come in but not this one fact for some policy reason? And I really have to ask, what's the legitimate policy reason for keeping that one fact out?
How do you know that the actual payment is relevant to the reasonable medical care and is not related to a whole bunch of other things?
Well, if that's something somebody wants to argue, they're entitled to do it. But I don't know. That, to me, is highly creative. That we negotiate every day. We negotiate, this is what I'm going to pay for a service. This is what I'm going to pay for something.
You might have gotten a better deal on the Buick than I did. Maybe they sold it to you for less than the fair market value because they have an interest in getting your legal services at a lesser price.
Well, then I think it's a perfect.
They're not going to get anything from me, so they can jack up the price.
It's a perfectly legitimate question to ask on cross-examination or to raise for the jury. He got that deal because he got a deal.
Well, the problem is your obligation first in presenting the evidence to show that it's sufficiently relevant and doesn't have enough other collateral extraneous matters.
Well, I have to wonder what these extraneous matters are in the healthcare context. My experience with the medical people is that they get a lot of extraneous things from the pharmaceutical salesman and the drug salesman who want them to write the prescription du jour. But they're not, to my knowledge, that the health insurers are awarding them trips to the Bahamas. And so I don't know where the foundation for that. I mean, I've heard that argument cast about, but I don't know where the foundation for that is. So.
Professor Presser.
Mr. Simpson, if this evidence comes in of what was paid for the jury's consideration, what is the instruction given to the jury?
Standard instruction, you determine the reasonable value of services. You may consider, I like the sentence from the Lautenschlager case, as a matter of fact. I think that's perfect, you'll pardon me for thumbing around to find it here. The amount paid of the liability incurred is evidence which will assist you in arriving at a reasonable award. Medical bill, there's a whole quote from Lautenschlager that's in my brief from page 630. But I think that very much sets up the groundwork for how a jury could use this to decide the matter. Let them make the choice. Let the finder of fact seek the truth. See, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Simpson. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Tim Aiken. I appear here with Jim Galanis, who is a co-writer on all our briefs. I'm going to answer the question, why did I enter into the stipulation I did? And the reason is simple, is that the proper reading of the Kaufman case is not even close to what Acuity maintains. And I can prove that to the court without referring to any sentence in the decision. The jury awarded in Kaufman $98,600. The trial judge then, Justice Seward from Menominee, reduces the award as a matter of law to $66,000 because he said that was the amount paid. That's how the case gets here, a matter of law reduction. This court, in a 5-2 decision, says, no, you don't reduce the award to the amount paid. Now, if Acuity was right, that's where the decision should have ended. And the jury verdict of 98 should have been reinstituted, because now we're through a matter of law. But that's not what happened. The court then went on to say, well, what are we going to do with this $98,000 award? Plaintiff asked the court to award the full 187, almost 188 that was being claimed. Court said, no, we can't do that because there was a dispute as to how much of the medicals, how much of the medicals were related to the accident. So the court then looked at it and said, well, maybe the jury awarded the $98,000 because they thought that's the amount of the total medicals that were related to the accident, $98,000. But the court was bothered by the fact that inadmissible, prejudicial, these are some of the words that were used by the court, evidence was allowed in front of the trier of fact. And that inadmissible, prejudicial evidence was the collateral source evidence of the amount paid. And the court ended up saying that the pernicious effect of the collateral source evidence, the amount paid, required a new trial on damages so that we could have a jury decide how much of the medicals now are related to this accident. How much are related to the accident without the jury hearing this pernicious, prejudicial, inadmissible evidence? So that's why I made the deal I did, because you cannot read Kaufman the way Acuity reads it. It's a decided case in 2001. It was a 5-2 decision, and the court in numerous paragraphs talked about, as Justice Bradley said, collateral payments should be prevented from affecting the verdict. Prejudicial effect. It's been universally held that such evidence is prejudicial error. As I said, pernicious effect of such evidence. Inadmissible was used twice on one page and irrelevant was used on the same page.
Why is it pernicious? If you tell the jury they can't just reduce the award by the amount that you receive from other sources, why is it pernicious to show the actual payment as being proof of what's reasonable?
Well, it's pernicious for two reasons. One is because the court said it is in a 5-2 decision.
I join that opinion, but okay, you have to persuade me again.
Right. But the real reason is, and I was, you know, Langerstorm is the case where we interpreted, or the court interpreted the medical statute. In the real world, juries have a hard time ciphering through all the public policy reasons that might come into play when you put amounts paid in. Just like there's many things that we don't allow juries to hear because they couldn't cipher through. They don't get to hear about my contingent fee. They don't get to know the effect of their verdict. They don't get to hear that this person had 6 prior drunk drivings when he was speeding this day, or he had 6 speeding tickets when he was speeding this day.
There's, Counselor,
it's prejudicial. I'm sorry.
Can I interrupt you just a minute? Does the amount paid assist the fact finder in making a determination of the reasonable value of the medical services?
The way I analyze the collateral source evidentiary.
No, I want you to look at relevance. Obviously, that's right. The question I'm asking.
One does not only look at relevance. One could potentially say that such evidence would be relevant in the absence of the evidentiary portion of the rule. However, the reason the rule was passed is because the prejudicial effect of the evidence outweighs its relevancy. It's too prejudicial, just like the other evidence that I just stated is not allowed in front of juries because it's been felt by the courts for over 100 years that this evidence is just too much, that the fact finder won't be able to see beyond it.
Counselor, the Chief Justice asked opposing counsel a lot of questions about, well, you can't show the amount that was paid, but you could bring an expert in to talk about why the amount that was billed isn't representative of the reasonable value, and one of the things is, well, nobody ever pays that. I don't see, can you tell me, do you think you can reconcile those two approaches? So even if you can't put in the bill or a statement to show what was paid, you could put in the same evidence through an expert about another number that's a lesser number than the amount billed.
I approach that issue this way. There, for years, Milwaukee County Hospital in Milwaukee, when it was operating as an institution, everybody in the county knew that their bills were about 50 to 60% above what every other hospital billed. Because they had so many uninsured people coming in, they made their bills larger so that they could help cover the uninsured. The question of what is an appropriate billing for a medical witness is what is the reasonable customary charge in the community. And so I dare say that Acuity couldn't find a witness to come in and say that the charges in this case, in fact, Acuity stipulated to this, that without this pernicious evidence that they wanted in front, they stipulated that that in the real world, doctors would say that this is the reasonable and customary charge. That's why we're able to come to the stipulation. This particular hospital, as was pointed out, there is, I think this hospital is Freighter, and right now we're in a fight with Freighter that they won't reduce an uninsured motor, uninsured person's medical bills. They say, no, we want the full amount. And we've made all the arguments that Acuity makes here about, well, you give this people deal and you give that people deal. And they said, forget it. We're not reducing the bill. So in the real world, the reasonable customary charge oftentimes is the amount billed. It's for people who don't give cash on the barrelhead. Work comp carriers often pay this amount. Your med pay payments pay this amount because it's the reasonable customary charge. There's a whole panorama of facts that go into this reduced billing. One is that these PPOs and HMOs can give these hospitals a full hospital so that they don't have to worry about having 6 or 10% of their beds empty at any one time. That's worth some money. Another reason is because it's really a guaranteed payment, so they don't have to worry about between 10 and 15% of their patients being uninsured or underinsured. Then, as the amicus brief points out, there's other benefits that are provided to the hospitals and doctors for entering into these PPO plans.
Counselor, but can't you bring that up in cross-examination like you do when any evidence is presented? So if the bill comes in and you get up and you say, well, hey, you know, you give a better deal to Blue Cross and Blue Shield because they just fill up your place, and so if you can afford to give them less. I mean, I don't see how that's different than any other kind of evidence that requires cross-examination.
Because we could do that with any fact that's not admissible evidence. We could do that with my attorney fees. The defense could explain how they shouldn't take into account my attorney fees.
You're mixing apples and oranges on me there. I mean, I asked to put, we could take this kind of a reasonable value and transport it over to reasonable value of attorney's fees under a mortgage. And I did ask opposing counsel some questions about that, but after thinking about it, I think they're probably not fair questions because there are too many other things going on. So
I couldn't agree more, because we don't do hourly billing, but I get involved in hourly billing issues as an expert witness. And, for example, one of the bigger firms in the state has like 7 different levels of billing for the same lawyer, depending on what they're working on. What's the reasonable value of that person's charge? There's a different charge for insurance companies than there is for corporations than there is for big corporations. That's a fact of capitalistic life. But in answer to your question, why don't we want to get this all in? Right. Trials take long enough already. It distracts the juries from the issue at hand. The issue at hand in this case was, why did Mr. Leininger fall through a floor in a construction site and fall 40 feet almost to his death?
Well,
that's the issue.
That's liability. And I agree, it's a very, very important issue. But we're really here on damages, which to your client is probably as important, so that there's compensation that's appropriate.
I think the public policy issue that you're addressing is, why would the collateral source rule only affects two types of people? People who cause injuries and deaths, okay, and who are more at fault than the plaintiff, and the victims. Those are the only two people that are concerned. People who are not found at fault, people who are found less at fault, people who don't cause bad accidents, they're not affected by collateral source.
Does it never apply to a contract action then? It's only a tort doctrine?
As far as I know, the collateral source is a tort doctrine only, and I think the Luxottica case supports that. But indirectly, you can infer that from it. It doesn't say it. But my point is that Mr. Leininger paid medical premiums for his lifetime. Why does the defendant wrongdoer who caused the injury to begin with, why does he or she get the benefit of his investment of a lifetime? And if they're going to get the benefit of that investment, where does it stop? If he pays for disability insurance for his whole life, do they get to reduce his loss of earning capacity? Life insurance? Is that a set-off for the widow's wrongful death action?
Counsel, why don't we just go the route, generally speaking, of the Lagerstrom case? And that is modified here, and say it can be put into evidence. It is admissible, and the court should instruct the jury how to use it.
Well, because in Langerstorm, one had a statute. The legislature invaded the area and made a declaration, so the court was bound by that. The fact the legislature didn't go further, I think, is important for the court. They went further on joint and several. They went further on other issues, including punitive damages. They did not enter this issue. The truth of the matter, to me as a trial lawyer, is that once that amount paid is put in, it is so prejudicial that we will spend either days or weeks trying to get a jury to disregard it, or we never will. We would have to distract the jury from the principles of the case that you're trying to case about and spend more time trying to explain why they shouldn't award only the amount paid than we would for all the important issues in the trial. The very reason that overly prejudicial evidence isn't allowed in applies 100% to these amounts paid. It's too prejudicial. We'll spend too much time on it. And the explanations are better handled by a court who's decided a collateral source rule than to be handled by a jury. Just like issues of hearsay, issues of character evidence, much, much prejudicial evidence that would be very important to juries is not allowed in because we have decided, the courts and the lawyers arguing to courts, that some of this evidence is just too prejudicial.
What's the majority rule on this?
The majority rule is that collateral source evidence is not allowed in evidence as a common law doctrine. And there's been a few courts that have changed the common law doctrine. There's been more legislatures that have changed it.
What is the policy reason why the amount paid shouldn't be the amount recovered?
Should or should not?
Should not.
I think the policy reason is because the amount paid is a reflective of many factors, which I listed. One is, if we accept a lesser amount, can you fill up my hospital so that I don't have 10% empty beds? If we accept a lesser amount, will you make sure I get paid? I mean, for example, in my profession, my contingent fee is a lot different than in a case where there's difficult liability than there is in a case where I know we're going to get paid, that the contingency is only when, not if. And so is the reasonable contingent fee what I charge in a rear-end accident versus a very difficult product liability case or a medical malpractice case? There's so many factors that go into amount paid that we'll take all this time trying to explain this to jurors who, at least the collateral source rule says, are not going to be able to see past the fact that it was just the amount paid. And the amicus points that out as well, but there's factors driving this. If in the real world, if you buy 1,000 widgets, you might pay $1 a widget. If you buy 1,000,000, you may only pay 20 cents a widget. What's the reasonable value of a widget then? And one of the things that was emphasized in Ellsworth and in Kaufman is that we don't want the vagaries of any particular insurance plan to affect the compensatory scheme. But I also think it's a very big fact that the tortfeasor, the person who's more at fault than the plaintiff or equally, who's caused grievous harm, they shouldn't profit from this man's investment in premiums for his lifetime. There's no windfall here. I mean, my goodness, for what one pays for insurance premiums, $6,000 to $12,000 a year for a family, there's windfalls involved. He's the one that made the investment. He should get the benefits of his investment, not the tortfeasor. So I think I think the fact that the legislature went as far as it did in the medical field, I think was bad policy. I think the legislatures that do it is bad policy. They're depriving people of the investment they made. So from a policy consideration, I don't know why anybody on either side of the political spectrum wants to change this rule. It's a good rule because it rewards investment. It's a good rule because it puts the burden on the tortfeasor. It's a good rule because it compensates the victim. I see nothing wrong with the rule. I want to just address briefly, the famous footnote 10, or at least famous in this case. Back in law school, when rules of pleading weren't as they were today, we were warned about a concept called the negative pregnant. An example of a negative pregnant is my daughter says, what time is my curfew? And I say, Mia, your curfew is midnight like it has been for the last 2 years. Well, why do I got to come home at midnight? And I look outside and I see it snowing. I say, well, the roads are bad. What I really should say is, for all the other 99 reasons I've told you your curfew is midnight, it's midnight, and besides tonight there's a special reason, the roads are bad. But when I say the roads are bad, I've left a negative pregnant. That is, as happened, Mr. Aiken, yes, Mia, there, she's my stepdaughter, the roads aren't bad out here. Can I stay out to 1? No, you can't stay out to 1. Well, you said the roads were bad was why I couldn't stay out. So there's a pregnancy potentially in paragraph 10 that says, well, after all, you agreed the bills are reasonable. I might add, that's exactly what happened here anyway. But you can't ignore 30 pages of writing that talks about pernicious effect and universally held and collateral source prevents the amount paid from affecting and say that because you made this statement that besides all that stuff, you stipulated this, that doesn't change the rule of the case. But, and that's why they call it a negative pregnant. So, I don't think there's any question.
154,000 is reasonable.
Because, first of all, the defense stipulated that if they couldn't get the collateral source, pernicious evidence, close print into evidence, that was a reasonable sum. That was stipulated to by the defense. And it was stipulated to because he was cared for at a leading hospital, and what their charges are the customer and usual charges in the community.
Suppose there were not a stipulation. How would we know that one?
Then I would have called an expert to talk about whether or not the bills at this hospital were the customer and usual charges in the community. Are they reasonable, and are they necessarily related to the accident suffered by Mr. Leidinger? And if the defense didn't believe that testimony, they could hire an expert to say, no, these are not the customer and usual charges. They can't hire an expert to say, well, hospitals accept a lot less than this. That's not the question. The question is, what is the customer and usual charges in the community? Because that's the charge that's the pure charge. The pure charge without the intervention of other capitalistic factors that may reduce that charge.
Have we ever said that the reasonable value of medical services is equal to the customary charge in the community?
I can't say that this court has ever said that. My guess is it has. I haven't looked it up, but I will tell you that's the question we ask in trial. Doctor, are these reasonable and that they are the customer and usual charges made in this community for this type of service? Or do you have an opinion? Yes, I have an opinion. What's the opinion? Yes, they are.
When I go out to fill up the tank in my automobile with gas, the customary charge seems to be the same everywhere in the community. Does that
really
make it reasonable?
I disagree with your premise. I travel all over the Midwest, and I will tell you that a gas station right on the freeway charges a penny or two less a gallon than a gas station in Pigsville that's way off the way. I mean, it could be 2-3 cents difference. It's even in the Milwaukee area, you can find gas stations that are 2 cents different within a square mile of one another, depending on where they're located and volume. And if they have a car wash, a car wash also brings the price down because they can charge less per gallon if they can get you into the car wash for $8. It's an exact example of what you're talking about. They are not the same charges. If you're near the Iowa border, charges are less. Why? Because they can drive across the border and pay about a dime less. So in order to stop going over the bridge, they charge less on the Wisconsin side.
I guess I'm going to have to fill up in La Crosse or something.
Oh, please. Whatever that is.
I'd love to give you a list of my favorite gas stations.
So what is the customary gas price then?
Well, the last I was at was $2.22.
Oh, if you were producing evidence.
I think the customary gas charge is what is the customary and usual charge of the community, and that's going to vary by a cent or two depending. But there are averages that are out there, and I think most gas station owners would say, you know, without a volume discount that you give or a car wash incentive that you get so that you make extra money, here's what the charge is, $2.22 a gallon. But if I can bring in $8 a car wash on 20-30% of the cars, I can reduce that. If I can have every one of my pumps pumping 24 hours a day, I can reduce that. That's capitalism. That's how it works.
I guess the point your opponent is making is that all, and you can refute this, but he's saying that, look, in my experience, that all of the billings from the hospitals are, he uses the word fantasy. In other words, they're all inflated by and he put this in his brief, 37% or 30%, but they're never realistic, and everybody knows that they're fantasy. So what is your argument in that area?
I need to pull out an envelope. I was hoping someone would ask me that question.
Well, good.
2006 medical charges for the Tim Aiken family, at least 25%. The amount billed is the amount paid. That's step one. Step two, something I wasn't ready to talk about until I decided to pull it out, when we talk about who incurred it. I have a $20,000 treatment charge here that hasn't been covered by insurance yet, and I had to pay it out of my pocket. Don't know if they're going to cover it. That's incurred. I have charges here. We have, I think we counted up seven, where the insurance company at present has refused to pay other charges.
Counselor, is this your client's medical bills? Is that what you're
saying? No, these are just me, because I saw all these allegations. And Mr. Simpson said it. He said, in my experience, and I'm telling you, in my personal experience, that just isn't true.
Okay.
And
right.
I think the truth of the matter is, and Ellsworth, I think, is an example of this, it isn't fantasy billings, it's fantasy payments. What Medicare, what Title 19, what Badger Care pays, all those payments are fantasy payments. Hospitals and doctors can't survive on those payments. That's why increasingly more doctors don't accept Medicare patients. They won't accept Title 19 patients if they're in a position to do so. Some doctors won't even accept some PPOs and HMOs because they're not getting paid enough of their customer and usual charge that they think that they can run their practice that way. So I only brought this along because I went, oh, my goodness, I can't believe how much this fantasy thing is a fantasy. And it's referred to in one of the dissents of the cases without a footnote. There is no evidence in front of this court that other than the Attorney General filing two complaints. Now, I say a fantasy billing is that prevalent. Why don't we have 2,000 complaints? Why do we have two? We should have hundreds of complaints of fantasy billings in this state if it's such a problem that they can't be explained by typical capitalistic principles. So in answer to your question, Justice Wilcox, no, in my experience, other than with Medicare, Title 19, Medicaid, Badger Care, the gap is not often that great. There are certain professions in the medical profession that suffer a bigger gap, and there's some hospitals whose day charge is greater than other hospitals. Typically, the teaching hospitals, because they have so many people to bear on a problem, have a higher charge than a lot of insurance companies think is should be reimbursed. But there's a reason people go to Frater, UW Hospital, Mayo, and some of the hospitals that charge a slightly higher charge. It's because of the level of care that one gets there when one has a difficult problem. And I dare say that, as in this case, you can't find a doctor to say that because Frater charges whatever it is more a day a bed, that it's not reasonable and necessary because of the quality of the care and the number of people that impact that patient at that hospital. It's much different than a hospital in Menominee, Wisconsin, or Wausau, or Tomahawk, even, where the hospital is small, and they don't have all those people to impact on the patient. So that's why some charges different as far as amounts billed.
Mr. Aiken, is the Lautenschlager case no longer good law?
The Lautenschlager case is good law and has nothing to do with this case. The question is, what is the customary usual charge or the reasonable charge in the community? Lautenschlager reinforces that. Lautenschlager was about a plaintiff who couldn't prove up his medicals. Couldn't prove up that they were associated with the accident was the primary problem he had. But one could read the case and infer from that he also had trouble proving up that the charges were reasonable. I don't read the case that way. I read the case that he had trouble proving up that they were related to the accident. He had trouble proving up what we call the necessary component. They weren't necessarily related to the accident in some form. So Lautenschlager, though, has nothing to do with collateral source. It has to do with how one proves up one's medical bills, which we were prepared to do except for the stipulation that the amount billed was reasonable if the inadmissible evidence wasn't allowed.
So what did you get paid?
So far, we have gotten paid the amount paid only because, I don't know, I can't remember if a checks were written. I don't think a checks were written because the petition was accepted. You know, I think one thing that the court should understand is that what we did here was we avoided days of trial in order to bring this issue in front of the court because Acuity and my friend Mr. Simpson felt strongly footnote 10 upset the primary part of the decision. I felt strongly it didn't. So my guess is, without talking to my bookkeeper, is we haven't yet been paid, but what we've been paid to date, as far as I know, is the amount paid, $111,000, and we have $47,000 coming.
If you win today.
If we win today. I'll say I have it coming even if I don't win, but I don't.
You don't get it none under any event.
If I don't win, in your decision, I do not get any more money.
So it's still it's not a moot case.
Oh, goodness, no. There's $40,000 plus an issue.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. Wouldn't want to get tripped up on that one. You know, I think unless there's a question from the court, I don't really think I have anything to add at this time, even though my time's not up.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Aiken. Mr. Simpson?
Well, Mr. Aiken talks about reasonable and usual charge in the community. That is the penultimate in begging the question. If you take a look at Leidinger, the Court of Appeals decision, paragraph 15, they quote from Kaufman at paragraph 27, and it says in there, a plaintiff who has been injured by the tortious conduct of another may recover the reasonable value, underline the word value, of medical services. We have explained that while the actual amount paid for medical services may reflect the reasonable value of the treatment rendered, the focus is on reasonable value, not the actual charge. In other words, this recovery is for the value, not for the expenditures actually made or obligations incurred. That's what the standard is, and that's why it is relevant under any set of circumstances to find out what was paid, what the market has paid here. That's what the reality is.
And then do you think reasonable value is the same as reasonable customary charge in the
community? No, I think reasonable value is what a jury determines. They have the right to consider.
Oh, what do you instruct them?
Well, as I said earlier, I like the comments. I think the Lautenschlager case, the quotation I had from that earlier, which I'm looking for.
Much fine, later. That's fine.
Counsel, when you're in trial, like Mr. Aiken was playing for us, and you were asking a expert witness regarding the reasonableness of the medical bills, what's the form of the question that you normally hear?
We're asking about the reasonableness of the medical bills?
I mean, when he was going through, is it reasonable and customary, that's a pretty common question that I would hear as a trial court judge.
Well, I think that's right, but I don't hear it reasonable. Is this amount reasonable and customary, I've heard? I mean, to double underline the word charges, I think some people do say it that way.
Or customary and usual in the community or something like that. Hmm?
Is this a reasonable amount, a reasonable charge? It depends on what you're looking at. Now, obviously, if you're in a case where the only thing there is the bill, you say, well, is this a reasonable bill or is it a reasonable charge? The question becomes then, are we allowed to put in what this person accepts as part of his economic formula as payment in full with respect to this matter?
In preparation for this today, I was reading a number of things, and I was looking at the law of damages in Wisconsin, you know, which is a several-volume treatise. And I was looking at the chapter written by Webster Hart on collateral source rule. And he says, and talking about the Lagerstrom opinion, he says, under the heading, Legislative Exceptions to Collateral Source Rule. This is at page 3, chapter 33. He says, Section 893.55.7 of the Wisconsin statutes allows evidence for compensation received from other sources in medical malpractice actions, and he gives a reference. It's the Lagerstrom. And then this is the important part. But for the existence of Section 893.55.7, the collateral source rule would prohibit juries from hearing evidence of the amounts received from other sources. You disagree with that, don't you?
Well, the way that's said, I think I have to, not having had a chance to ponder it. But the Lagerstrom court indicated that the statute did not inform the jury of what it could do with collateral source evidence, so the court developed guidelines based on common law principles and the guideline was that the collateral source evidence is to be considered in considering the reasonable value of services.
He goes on to say and discuss the Lagerstrom case, but essentially the 893.55.7 is legislative action in derogation of the common law of collateral source rule. And anyway, that's his conclusion. But for that specific statute, 893.55.7, the collateral source rule would prohibit juries from hearing evidence of the amounts received from other sources.
And my rejoinder to that is two comments. One, why is the collateral source rule of such import that you would want to strip the jury from the right to hear what was paid for the bills and let them decide what's reasonable? If the plaintiff wants to argue that, gee, there's some deal here or they should get more, that's fine. I really take issue with the idea that, gee, it's too hard to do this. I think the defense would love a rule that if something was too hard, we didn't have to do it, because that would certainly undercut a barnyard of liability theories. But I think that's the underlying issue that I keep coming back to.
Counselor, I hate to keep you, but I have one question I asked opposing counsel and I want to ask you. And my question went to relevance, and he really responded under more like 90403, and it was pernicious, I think that was the word he chose, to have the amount paid come in. Can you address 90403 with this evidence? Is it unfairly prejudicial? Yes, no, and why?
Why in the I guess that's a good question. Why in the world would it be unfairly prejudicial? Every kind of service, you're looking for the value of a piece of property. What is it? It's what a willing seller and a willing buyer would pay in an arm's-length transaction. That's the jury instruction. That's life. That's relevant evidence, at least as relevant for a jury to consider. You can jump up and down and yell pernicious till you're blue in the face, but the fact is, that's what's relevant to decide what's a fair charge for a service. What are people expecting to do that, to perform that service? I don't think there's anything even close to 90403 considerations with respect to this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Simpson,
you.
And thank you, Mr. Akin, for your arguments today in yet another collateral source rule case. That closes our argument in 05AP2030, Leidinger versus Van Buren Management. The court will be in recess until 1:30, and if the Whitewater students wish to remain, there are some high school students who are coming in with the Court of Glass program, and Justice Wilcox will talk about the procedures of the court in hearing and deciding cases. I would urge you to stay, if you can. We're in recess.